It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. For all that's gone right with Governor Wolf's administration, one persistent headache has been the controversy over his choice to head the state police, Marcus Brown. Brown's decision to wear the Pennsylvania State Police uniform without going through the training academy has drawn criticism, as has his decision to take down signs critical of his nomination and decision to wear the state police uniform posted in March near his Camp Hill home. Brown was questioned about those choices and more by state senators at his nomination hearing yesterday. 90.5 WESA's Emily Previty covered the hearing and joins us now by phone from Harrisburg. Good day, Emily.
Hi, Paul. Thanks so much for having me.
How would you sum up the atmosphere at yesterday's hearing?
It was pretty steady the entire time. Brown's faced many of these questions multiple times already since being nominated by Governor Wolf. So a lot, he expected all of it from what it seems like. And everyone was generally, the lawmakers, even those that were criticizing Brown, were generally respectful, even complimentary of him, as they indicated, as State Senator Scott Wagner did, that he was not going to support his nomination. As I said, it was a pretty level sort of atmosphere, and it seems that Brown did have a lot of supporters in the audience who applauded a couple of times when this state senator, who was most staunchly supportive of him, spoke.
And we'll get to the pros and cons, the supporters and the dissenters, including Scott Wagner, here momentarily. But, Emily, it was expected that the uniform controversy would come up. How did it surface at the hearing yesterday?
So about a half an hour in, State Senator Scott Wagner from York County, he's a Republican, he asked Brown why he wasn't in uniform that day. Brown was wearing a suit and tie. And so he said, I'm here representing myself on my own behalf, and I'm wearing the uniform only to honor the state police and to represent the agency. And that would be appropriate at, an official event, like a promotional ceremony or swearing in or something like that, but not there where he, again, was there representing himself.
Hmm. So he's been wearing the uniform, and it's brought all sorts of unwanted attention to him and to the Wolf administration's choice. And yet here was his big moment at the nomination hearing, and he did not wear the uniform yesterday. Did anybody else bring it up or criticize him for maybe seeming a little hypocritical?
What Wagner went on to say was that he felt that Brown was qualified for the job. He, complimented his experience in relative detail, and then said, but, I'm not going to support you because of the uniform issue. It's just become too big of an issue. That was the most time that was spent on it, quite honestly. It wasn't, there wasn't a lot of redundancy in the hearing. It seemed that each lawmaker had a specific point that they stressed, and I know that you're probably going to ask me about some of them later, but there were multiple issues that the Republican lawmakers on the panel had problems with, and each of them sort of focused on a different one.
Let's listen to an excerpt from the hearing, from the comments that you referred to, Emily. Here is York County Republican Senator Scott Wagner keying on Brown's decision to wear the state police uniform, which has been very controversial, without going through the training academy.
You have a very, very impressive resume, in which I commend you. But I will tell you that today, when the vote comes from your confirmation, I will be casting a negative vote. And my main reason is focused around the uniform issue.
How did Brown react to this criticism, Emily?
He pointed out that Wagner was supporting his experience and basing his decision on whether to support him off of Brown's choice of attire. And he pointed out that many leaders of law enforcement agencies adopt that agency's uniform, and said that he wasn't really doing anything different from that, and that he has spoken with troopers who appreciate his choice. And again, those were explanations that, if you've been following this, you've heard before. He was pretty well prepared to defend and address all of these points, you know, pretty calmly.
And Emily, just so people understand why there is a controversy here, that Marcus Brown is wearing this uniform, and he's saying it's done elsewhere. So the issue comes down to the fact that he did not go to the training academy. Is that really what it's about?
Well, right. And his point was that this happens where, and I don't, he says that it happens frequently, and I have not fact-checked that, even if the person isn't someone who, even if they come from a different law enforcement agency, they may still wear this agency they're now heading. They may still adopt that uniform. And you're right, he didn't rise up through the ranks in the Pennsylvania State Police. He spent most of his career in the city of Baltimore and then was head of the Maryland State Transit Authority Police and then the Maryland State Police before being nominated for this position by Governor Wolf. So, you know, that is where the controversy comes from.
Had he worn the uniform in the past?
What do you mean?
In Maryland when he was in the...
Yes.
So he wore the uniform there. There was no controversy there, but there is here. Okay, so that that at least clears up some of that. He also addressed his decision to take down the signs critical of his nomination and decision to wear the state police uniform. These were signs that were posted in March near his Camp Hill home. Let's listen to that.
For law enforcement, we work our entire careers to shield our family away from the jobs that we do every single day.
So he was criticized for taking those signs down, but his explanation that he offered yesterday was that I'm protecting my family. These are signs that are basically a roadmap to where I live, and I didn't feel that they were appropriate, so that was his justification. How did this explanation, Emily, seem to go over with senators at the hearing?
No one really took much exception with that. That was a jumping-off point, I think, for the most staunchly supportive of them, Anthony Williams, Democrat from Philadelphia, who picked up on that point and sort of said, "Who can't understand that?" You know, one of the state senators, and you'll have to forgive me, I don't remember who, did say, "You know, I mean, we're to sort of counter Williams' point." One of the Republicans mentioned that we are kind of calloused, perhaps, being in public life for as long as we have been to personal attacks, personal criticism that's public. So there was a little of both, but I think Williams sort of overshadowed this and really stressed the point that, you know, that in his mind, there's no one that shouldn't be able to understand a concern for one family's safety.
We're talking with 90.5 WESA's Emily Previty, who covered the hearing that occurred yesterday, the nomination hearing for Marcus Brown, who is the acting head of the state police. He is Governor Wolf's choice to be the head of the state police, but that, of course, is pending the approval from the legislators. And the uniform controversy wasn't the only thing that was asked about. Emily, what other topics came up, and how did Marcus Brown respond?
Well, they asked about his positions on Naxalone, which is an antidote for heroin overdoses, and you know he said he supports state troopers carrying that and hopes that it will help more, serving as an example for more local departments. They also asked for his position on gun control, and he said that he would not advocate for more restrictive legislation in Pennsylvania, and they asked about his position on the death penalty. He said, you know, I'll enforce whatever laws are in place, at which point Williams jumped in, again, defending him, saying, you know, are we going to ask him for his stance on every policy point because we'll be here till 5 o'clock? Who cares? Let's stay focused on the issue at hand. He was asked about his tax breaks. He and his family apparently receive on two properties they own, one in Camp Hill and one in Maryland. And, you know, those tax breaks total less than $100 per year. Another, a point that Williams found ridiculous. And he also was asked about pensions that he receives from the City of Baltimore Police Department and the State of Maryland. He gets about $24,000 a year from the State of Maryland, served eight. That was calculated and awarded according to protocol and didn't stir any kind of controversy, but the City of Baltimore Police Department pension that he's receiving at $55,000 per year, when that was awarded, there was some objection to it because of, the contention that his job was not abolished as is required for someone with his tenure to qualify for retirement in the city. So that was a little bit controversial.
Did any of the senators support Marcus Brown? You mentioned earlier there was support. Where did it come from, and is it enough?
Well, the three, if I had to decide, you know, to say if there was anyone who was perfectly clear about their position, you know, Wagner said he's not going to support Brown. Williams most certainly is. If it doesn't seem like State Senator John Rafferty is going to. The Republican leadership generally has said that they don't support the nomination. So, you know, then I would say, no, it's not enough, but we'll have to see. This now goes to the full Senate for a vote, because yesterday the committee didn't take any position on supporting the nomination.
And to paraphrase, or actually I'll give a direct quote from Democratic Senator Anthony Brown from Philadelphia, apparently no relation. He said, quote, "You need to be commended, not interrogated. We need to support you moving forward. You represent the best of America, the best of Pennsylvania," end quote. So very strong support coming from Democratic Senator Anthony Brown of Philadelphia. But again, we don't know what the tally is and whether that support is representative of a substantial amount or number of senators. So what ultimately, Emily, is the takeaway from yesterday's nomination hearing, and what happens next?
Well, I guess that this, like we said before, is controversial, and if you're using yesterday as sort of a litmus test, it might be close, but it's likely to split along party lines. And I did just want to mention that it is Anthony Williams, not Brown, just so people don't get confused about that, who was a Democrat who was supporting him. So confusion over the last.
Thank you for clarifying that. With regard to the June 9th, that date is significant, because if there is not a vote taken by then, what happens?
So if that happens, Brown will continue to serve in an acting capacity, and Wolf will have to resubmit a nomination. And I followed up with his office yesterday just to clarify that, and it seems that even if the nomination isn't supported, they may be seeing the same name again in the fall. So it seems like the Wolf administration is really serious about defending their choice. And the other thing I would say is that even though there's controversy over some of the things in Brown's background, and no one is disputing that he's unqualified for the position. And another point that Williams was making that I thought it might be important to mention is he believes that the root of the opposition to Brown is his commitment to increasing diversity in the state police. And asked about that afterwards by the media, whether he agreed with that, he sort of deferred and didn't really answer the question, and didn't really say he agreed or disagreed with that.
90.5 WESA's Emily Previty, who covered acting state police commissioner Marcus Brown's nomination hearing yesterday, joining us by phone from Harrisburg. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Last week, Commonwealth Court President Judge Dan Pellegrini granted a motion filed by the state ordering UPMC to accept Highmark's Medicare patients. UPMC says it will appeal the decision to the state Supreme Court. So what happens next? I'm joined now by Pittsburgh Business Times healthcare reporter Chris Mamula. Chris, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. How are you?
Thank you, Paul. My pleasure.
Chris, break down the Commonwealth Court Judge Dan Pellegrini's decision here and what it means.
The biggest part of it that people will see right away is that for 182,000 Highmark members, they will continue to have in-network, which means lower cost, access to UPMC hospitals. That's the biggest thing right off the bat.
And so what else did the judge order here? Because that is the thing that got the screaming headlines, but there's a lot more to parse through with regard to his decision.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, Paul. He made some other points. He said that he wants all of the outstanding issues between contractual issues between UPMC and Highmark resolved by September 30th, which is an ambitious deadline given everything that's happened. But he wants those things that divide them identified or listed by July 1st and then resolved by September 30th, which is going to be really a feat considering the past year. So those are the big things. The last part of it, the unusual part, the teeth actually that Judge Pellegrini put into this was he asked the state, the Commonwealth, for a supplemental relief measure. He wants something written down on paper that the state is going to use to help enforce all of this, to bring these guys to the table and to work things out. And he said, including but not limited to changes in corporate governance, which is huge. The Attorney General has the authority and has used it in the past in other nonprofits to change board of directors and to take over organizations, to take sweeping kinds of actions like that. So it's will we see the board of directors at UPMC or Highmark changed or modified? Maybe not, but it's a measure, a reflection of the judge's seriousness about this.
Was anybody surprised by this decision? What has the reaction been?
The big surprise came from UPMC, obviously. They had argued long and hard at last week's hearing in Harrisburg that the Medicare Advantage plans are not part of Medicare. They had tried to distance themselves or distance the two things, the two concepts, the two programs. And Judge Pellegrini rejected that. He says, you know, basically they fit the definition of a Medicare program. You can't separate the two. So I guess UPMC is the most unhappy with it. They felt as though the judge had exceeded his authority. He had provided relief that no one had asked for, and they appealed. They appealed Monday to the state Supreme Court.
And that is, if nothing else, is one of the reasons why having this all resolved by the fall would seem to be a ridiculous deadline at this point, to put it mildly. We're talking with Chris Mamula, who is the Pittsburgh Business Times healthcare reporter. He's with us here in studio, and we're talking about the decision last week by Pennsylvania Commonwealth Court ordering UPMC to accept Highmark's Medicare patients. If you have a comment or question about this and how it may impact you going forward, 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Again, 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. UPMC, as we've pointed out, as you've pointed out, Chris, says it will appeal this decision to the state Supreme Court. How long, realistically, do you see this playing out?
This particular part of it, Paul, they have to come up with a resolution fairly quickly. Highmark and everyone else, actually, is preparing to make Medicare plan offerings for the fall. So they have to have these plans approved by Medicare. And so there's time's running out that the Supreme Court, my guess is going to have to hear this and take some action fairly quickly.
So with that in mind, will they adjust the schedule accordingly?
as far as rollout of the new products.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that they have that luxury. I think they're committed to a certain time frame to offer these plans in time for people to choose different options. So I'm not sure that they're going to have that. I think that it'll be incumbent on the state Supreme Court to act quickly. And they can do one of two things. They can agree to hear the case. They can say, no, we don't want to hear it. So it's if they don't hear it, that means that Judge Pellegrini's order stands.
Governor Wolf was pleased with this decision, and he seemed to take this opportunity to scold UPMC a bit, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, Paul. And it seems like that early in the Wolf administration, they sided or came out against not only the governor, but some Democratic legislators have also come out against UPMC and the idea of cutting these seniors. Medicare Advantage members are people who are over 65, and they are they fit the definition of a vulnerable population. And the state agreed, and everybody agreed actually a year ago, that to protect these vulnerable populations, children and old people, from any kind of wrangling back and forth between UPMC and Highmark. So yeah, they certainly have come out against them.
Here is the direct quote from Governor Wolf, who issued the statement and said, quote, "From the beginning, I have been very clear that I will not stand by and allow our most vulnerable citizens, especially seniors, to be used as pawns in the dispute between UPMC and Highmark," end quote. As a business reporter and looking at the public relations damage that is that both of these healthcare entities are inflicting upon themselves over this dispute, how would you assess what has happened here?
Well, certainly there's the public relations aspect of it too. That's an awful thing. You know, the prospect of cutting these people out of in-network access, Medicare Advantage people just generally don't have the same incomes as everyone else. They don't make as much money, so they're harmed by this. Being cut out of the network means that they have to cough up more out of their own pocket for care. So that's a tough thing. There's also a financial aspect to it, too. Commercial insurance generally pays, has a margin for hospitals. Margin might be a four-letter word in nonprofits, but it's true. Commercial insurance generally has a margin of 10%, which is great. You'd love to get that. Medicare Advantage is the second most profitable for margin treating these patients, and the margin's about 1%. So in the decision to cut them out of the in-network is with the possibility of alienating them. Is kind of a puzzle. You would think that that UPMC would have be more concerned about that. So it's I'm not sure. It has a financial consequence, and it certainly has a public relations consequence. And I'm not sure that the black eye is just for UPMC. I think people feel that it's both Highmark and UPMC that both need to put down the guns and work together.
What are the comments that you hear from people and from your readers about this?
A lot of anger, a lot, and you know, number one would have to be confusion. It's just gone back and forth so many times that it's hard to keep it all straight. It's just, I would say, confusion. Second is just anger that these are nonprofits and they should behave better, basically.
I would be remiss if I didn't bring up a larger issue that it could create similar confusion, and that is the pending Supreme Court decision about Obamacare, which is coming perhaps, it sounds like, later this month.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah, that's what we understand. The Supreme Court should roll later this month, and the issue just revolves around the Affordable Care Act. Four words, actually, in the Affordable Care Act, that refer to state insurance exchanges that have to be in place where people can get their coverage, and in states like Pennsylvania and 33 other states. We don't have a state exchange. We use just basically the federal model. It's called a federally facilitated exchange in Pennsylvania and elsewhere. Well, the challenge says, you know, that's not according to the law. The law is that this has to be from the state. So they will decide whether or not this is illegal. If it is not, if the Supreme Court rules that this is not a legal procedure, then all the people in Pennsylvania and in the other states without a state exchange will suddenly be without their subsidies. This is money that they use tax credits and other benefits that help them make health insurance affordable. It would be a huge thing. Governor Wolf has applied to Medicare to set up a state exchange. He said he just wants this in place just in case. So, but I don't know that when it happens, you know, a lot of the details are going to be uncertain. This is really uncharted waters.
Right. It seems as though there will be massive confusion. One other thing that I'm wondering about is if Governor Corbett had gone along and set up the exchange the way it was intended by the Obama administration in the first place, would there be, an impending problem like we might face if the Supreme Court does rule against the Obama administration later this month?
We would not be facing this had it been set up the way it was envisioned by the Affordable Care Act. We would not be facing this.
Is there any chance that Wolf can do that? Because he has said that's his intention, but can he do it in time?
It's a $10 question. He has to get it. You know, the legislature would have to be behind him on this. He's applied for it. I mean, it's that's a good question. I don't think anyone knows the answer, really.
So last but not least, getting back to the UPMC Highmark dispute, you're thinking that it could resolve itself this summer. My last question I always like to end with is what happens next? What will we see as a result of what was decided last week in court, in Commonwealth Court?
Well, Judge Pellegrini said, work this stuff out. July 1st, tell me who you want the arbiters to be for binding arbitration, and I want all this stuff settled by September 30th. It's very ambitious. And there's two issues that have to be resolved or should be resolved in that time. And both of them are, they just don't come more thorny or more harder to work out. And the first is continuity of care. Like, what does that mean? It was in the consent decree that Highmark and UPMC signed last year. But what does continuity of care mean? The idea was that if someone were seeing a UPMC doctor, that they could continue to see them on an in-network basis. But what kind of continuity of care was that thought? Was that just someone who saw a UPMC doctor for a sore throat, they can continue seeing them? Is it a wide or a broad interpretation of that? Or was it something more narrow, just somebody with heart disease or diabetes or, you know, organ transplant, whatever, something, things more serious? So that's going to be a tough one. The other thing, and maybe every bit as difficult or harder, is oncology fees. Mickey Poole, one of the attorneys, UPMC attorneys, described the oncology fee issue as the tripwire for this whole lawsuit and this whole motion by the attorney general to get it resolved. And it was, in fact. Highmark dug in its heels and said, you know, you and every other health system in America is entitled, according to Medicare, to a premium payment for chemotherapy that's administered, depending on whether it's in the doctor's office or in a hospital outpatient clinic. But you know what? We're not paying it. We're not paying it because it doesn't do anything for the patient's care. You're giving them the same drug, same dosage, same everything. It's just that you get more money if you get more reimbursement if you provide the treatment in something called a hospital outpatient clinic rather than a doctor's office. So, that's been probably the hardest of all. It's the issue that underlies this entire hearing from last week. And it's an issue nationwide, too. Highmark was the first in the country to push back against the oncology premium.
We've been talking with Pittsburgh Business Times healthcare reporter Chris Mamula about last week's Commonwealth Court decision granting a motion filed by the state ordering UPMC to accept Highmark's Medicare patients. Chris Mamula, thank you for helping us navigate a thorny issue.
Thank you, Paul.
Coming up, the Three Rivers Arts Festival begins this weekend. We'll have a preview. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. Great. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The 10-day Three Rivers Arts Festival begins this weekend. This year, the annual celebration comprising concerts, art exhibits, and food will highlight artists new to the festival. Joining us in studio to provide an overview of this year's festival is Three Rivers Arts Festival Director Veronica Corpus. No stranger to the program, but it's been a while. Good to see you, Veronica. Welcome back. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing well.
Each year, a theme is selected for the Three Rivers Arts Festival. Tell us about this year's theme and what inspired it.
Well, this year's theme really culminated out of a conversation with my colleague and theater artist, Shonda Erica Miles. We were discussing topics that range from the invisibility of women of color to the silence that surrounds hospice spaces and the terminally ill. And from that conversation really kind of grew out the desire to bring to light narratives, stories, individuals who find themselves more at the margins of popular culture and even popular art. And so with that intent, we sought to kind of find artists and both visual and the performance art, and also highlight emerging artists who are new to the festival, maybe even new to the region, and some of the national touring acts who might have new work that they want to showcase. And it's been a great framework to kind of organically coalesce all the programming that has shaped this $56 Bank Three Rivers Arts Festival.
And it is an interesting contrast, thinking about, as I listen to you say this, that so much of the summer is spent with nostalgic groups coming through town that you grew up with, that, you know, are crowd favorites and that you see at fairs and festivals year after year. So I don't know if it was a conscious decision on your part to try to freshen up what is being presented at the Three Rivers Arts Festival, but was that factored into your thinking at all?
Sure. You know, it's 10 days of programming for the main stage performances. You know, that's 10 national touring acts, and wanted to provide an opportunity for Pittsburghers to see artists like Benjamin Booker. They may have seen him open for Jack White, but here's a chance to see a full set of his new work. Or traditional artists like the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra and the Pittsburgh Opera. And then some younger kind of singer-songwriters, whether it's Jenny Lewis, Milo Green, Hooray for the Riff Raff. It's a kind of a great mix of artists that kind of range in varying styles and genres. But hopefully there's a little bit of something for everyone to enjoy, because it is really a civic celebration of all the arts and the entire community. And we want to try to be as inclusive as possible in those programming selections.
And who are you particularly excited about seeing? I know that you're trying to produce art for the masses, but I'm sure there are certain things that, as you develop themes like this, who is making you excited at this point?
Sure. In terms of the music, since we've been on that topic, Rhiannon Giddens, although she's performed at the Arts Festival before with the Carolina Chocolate Drops, she's bringing to Pittsburgh her brand new album. And we have a special festival dinner that night at Eddie Merlot's, a nice fundraiser to help support our programs. But I think her work and her voice is just a stunning thing to witness live in the open air. And I really am very much looking forward to that. In terms of the public art, we have four different visual art installations that will be presented this year and curated by Nadine Wasserman that are both commenting on the theme of Unseen Unheard, as well as reflecting upon the history of Point State Park in the region. And so that's another component that I'm very, very much anticipating and can't wait to open tomorrow.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with Three Rivers Arts Festival Director Veronica Corpus. And there are always new things that come up in addition to the theme at this year's festival. What are the new things that people have to look forward to?
I would say the brand new partnership that we're very excited about is the Create Festival. So it's a festival within a festival in partnership with the Carnegie Mellon University and Pittsburgh Technology Council. The Create Festival, which is Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, is a collection of different forums, panel discussions, salons that explore the intersection of art and technology. So this is a brand new look at disciplines in industrial design, robotics, and how artists are kind of working with these new technologies to create their work. So we welcome all the festival goers to the Wyndham Hotel to participate in this free programming. And it adds, I'd say, about almost 40 different individual events that are free and open to the public. So we're really excited about that. This year, we also have a focus on dance on the first weekend, and then the second weekend, the literary arts. So artist Jaziri X will lead a panel discussion on hip-hop and the power of language in our Trust Arts Education Center. We have some visiting poets, and then also poets Tamika Cage Connolly and Dave Newman will be reciting on the Dollar Bank main stage. So it's a great swath of different genres and artists, but definitely the Create Festival is something brand new.
And there are always people that are, I'm sure, thinking about if we're only going to go for one day or two, what are the days we should circle on our calendar? So
don't do it. Back multiple days. You have to do it.
What are the highlights, though? What are the things that, you know, if you can't miss? You just absolutely can't miss.
Well, I would say a weekend is a really good time to come down. And I'd start early. Our hours open 12 o'clock noon. And that's when the artist market opens. And you can take in over 100 different artists specializing in handmade, handcrafted, fine art, fine craft. And you can purchase art, you can talk to the artists, you can learn about their process. And it's an experience you can't have on the internet or in a mall. This is something that's very unique. And we're thrilled to have in total over 350 artists in the market. So you start there, maybe take in a meal in our concession area, a concert at the stage. There's the family area that you can do some hands-on activities with artists in different groups and just learn about a slew of things. And then if you have time to run to the Trust Arts Education Center, where we have two different exhibitions and a dance performance, I would definitely try to do that and squeeze in a film next door at the Harris Theater and then come back to the Point State Park gateway area to see all the public art and then cap the night off with a concert. One day.
Yeah, and it's all within walking distance once you find a place to park down there.
It is. You know, we recommend, as one of the greenest arts festivals of its kind in the country, we recommend taking alternative transportation, whether it's the T or biking down. We have our own bike valet, thanks to the Qualcomm Foundation for providing all of those kind of greening of our operations. But you can do that and then take the T from Point State Park and Gateway Center into the Cultural District, and lots of different modes of transportation throughout. And there's our new bike lane. You can pedal up and see the galleries. But the best planning advice is to visit the website and to pick up a program at our information tent and explore from there.
And in case one or the other of us has not already mentioned it, this is all free, right?
It is. It is all free.
You have to pay for the food.
The food and the art.
Yeah.
If you're going to purchase art. But there's one special public art installation called the Lost and Found Factory by Pittsburgh native Michelle Illuminato. She's taken over the Visit Pittsburgh former information booth on Stanwyck Street. And you bring your story of a lost item you lost long ago. And she has over 14 artists working over the 10 days, kind of recreating that object into a work of art, which you can take with you. And I anticipate long lines, and we're going to have some kind of capacity issues there, but that's free. And that's a little piece of art that's commissioned especially for you when you...
Something you've lost.
Something you lost, yeah.
It could be jewelry. It could be a toy. It could be...
My story is the medallion that was owned by my mother, and she gave it to... Or my grandmother, who gave it to my mother, who gave it to me when I was a child. So that's my story. I lost it at Monroeville Mall.
Oh, my
God. In 1980-something.
That story tops mine. Mine was my parents selling my Lost in Space robot at a garage sale.
Yeah.
If I showed up and asked about that,
I
would an artist...
I think I see a tear.
Yes. So you're saying an artist could conjure up some kind of robot, maybe?
Something. It might not be to size and exactly as the object was, but it will be an artful rendering of that memory.
That's cool. That sounds like fun. Have you gotten an artist's rendering of your medallion yet?
Not yet, because the Lost and Found factory opens tomorrow at noon. So hopefully maybe I'll get a sneak peek prior to that.
Okay. Well, good luck with that. And I don't know where to go with that. It's such a sad way to end.
No, it's happy.
Yeah, it's all good. And the artist will restore your memories, if not your actual lost items. And that's a fabulous new addition to the festival.
Well, you can make new memories at the Arts Festival because there's just really so much to see and hear and do. And we really welcome the whole community and visitors to take it in and to come back more than once over the 10 days.
Sounds like a good idea. Veronica Corpus is the Three Rivers Arts Festival director and joined us here in studio to talk about the festival, which starts, it goes for 10 days and it starts this weekend. And Veronica, so nice to see you. Thanks for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Great to be here.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It's that time of year when the celebratory focus turns to dads and grads. Contributor Elaine LaBalme, who tweets about food and travel under the Twitter handle New Girl in Town, joins us this week with travel suggestions dear old dad is sure to enjoy. I guess Father's Day is sneaking up on us. Hi, Elaine.
Hey, how are you?
All right, New Girl, Father's Day right around the corner, June 21st to be exact. Still time to plan for a memorable day or a weekend getaway, but I guess now's the time to do it, right?
You got to do it right away. Now, I will say this, and I'm not sure that this is fair, but it seems that Mother's Day weekend just books up so much more quickly than Father's Day weekend. So I'm thinking dads are getting a little bit of short shrift on their special day, which maybe is all the more reason to try and book something. I mean, it can be anything from sort of a special type of steak vacation to something really not that far away. It doesn't have to be extravagant, but I think the important thing is just to acknowledge them, you know, remember them, and try to make a fun experience that'll create some memories.
And you've got some suggestions that for that very special man in your life. First up, a place which your husband, Fenn, a dad himself, claims dad's love.
Now, what he tells me about this place is that it's the only place he's been to where every dad is always smiling. So this is the one place where they don't have to carry around all these bags and fuss and get dragged from one thing to the other. And what I'm talking about, believe it or not, is Kalahari Water Park. It is this fantastic water park in Sandusky, Ohio. So just in the shadow of Cedar Point. Yes, it is huge. It's something like 180,000 square feet of absolute fun. Indoor, outdoor water park. It's one of those where you basically get there. You don't need to bring anything other than your swimsuit, right? And then you've got everything from the lazy river to the crazy slides, coasters, wave pool. And, you know, I agree with Fenn. People are always laughing and smiling there. It's hard not to like. So this is something that's maybe a 2.5-hour drive away. You can easily take dad there, granddad even for the day. There's
You're saying
something...
dads aren't hard to please.
Well, yeah. Judging from my own husband, not too terribly hard to please. No. So anyway, you can go to the one in Ohio. Or if you can't get away on Father's Day weekend, I'll just mention that Kalahari is about to open a new park in the Poconos early July. So if you want to be the first one at the super brand new swanky park, just wait a couple weeks. You can do it.
Sticking with the water theme, you say most anything on or around water is appealing.
Well, yeah, that's my thinking, especially in the summer when the temperatures go up. A couple things come to mind. Get out to Cheat Lake in West Virginia, one of the nearby lakes, reservoirs, streams. They're great for fishing, great for houseboating. I mean, that's what, maybe a couple of hours from us here in Pittsburgh. So easy to get to, great way to spend the day or the weekend. The other thing that always rates high with not only my husband, but a lot of other dads I know in these parts is rafting, whitewater river rafting on the Yauk River. In Ohio Pyle State Park. That's less than 2 hours away. Easy to do, but book with one of the outfitters right away because they probably will be busy that weekend. And if you get shut out, there's those great natural water slides in Ohio Pyle as well. Pack the picnic and make a day out of it.
And for landlubbers, there's golf and several different forms of golf available, and sounds like any one of them will do.
Well, I got to tell you, the one I want to talk about is disc golf, in that the Professional Disc Golf Association, that is a thing, their world championships will be in Pittsburgh this year, maybe the first time ever, August 1 through 8. So think about practicing now. This is my favorite staycation idea. It's a great disc golf course in Schenley Park. There's one in Moraine State Park, not too far away. Deer Lake Park's the northern end of the county. Slippery Rock area has one as well. More information at the Pittsburgh Flying Disc Society. Go to their website for places and more information on the courses. And, you know, if you're a ball golf person as opposed to a disc golf person, you can get out to Bedford Springs. Tons of courses there. Or Nemacolin in the Laurel Highlands has some nice golfing as well.
And you say a beach weekend will likely keep not only dad, but mom happy.
That is my thinking. And again, the temps are rising. By the time mid-late June rolls around, you will want to get to a beach. One I like this time of year is Chincoteague Island in Virginia. You know, the old pony swim, Misty of Chincoteague and whatnot. The ponies don't swim till late July. If you go there this time of year, it is one of the quietest, most uncrowded beaches you will find. I have been there in June, and it's just a lovely time to go. You got to check out Woody's Beach Barbecue.
I know nothing about that. So horses get into the water?
Oh, the ponies. Yes, the annual pony swim and sail. This is something that's been going on in Chincoteague for, I don't know, years, decades. Yeah, they have, there are a lot of the wild ponies.
It's kind of like Adult Swim. You want to get out of the water when they show up.
You don't want to be anywhere near the water. Something close to 100,000 people show up every year for this pony swim. Yeah, it is a big deal. So get there in June, a bit more crowded in late July. My favorite place to eat in the area, Woody's Beach Barbecue. Oh, that is some good barbecue. And you know I was not going to leave without talking about barbecue or food. Favorite place to stay, the Refuge Inn. It's a great spot near the Chincoteague National Wildlife Refuge. Rent a bike, go in through the refuge, great birding.
Okay, we have about 30 seconds. There was one other thing you wanted to mention.
One last thing. If you can't do anything with dad over Father's Day or that weekend, buy tickets now for the All-Star Game, which is in Cincinnati, close by, Tuesday,
July
14th.
Are they still available?
Well, there's always the aftermarket, Paul.
Oh,
you can always get
tickets. Where you're going
tickets. Well, how much do you love dad?
I love him a lot.
There you go.
But I think we'll be in front of the TV. But
hey,
that's,
you know,
a good idea.
We're going to have some buckos in that All-Star game this year, don't you
yes,
think?
Yes, we better. We
there
better.
You go.
Vote now.
Agreed.
All right. Elaine LaBalm, our travel contributor. Thanks, Elaine.
You bet.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. Tomorrow on the program, we will talk with NPR Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep about his new book about Andrew Jackson. That's coming up tomorrow. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.